All right, I want to invite you now, if you will, to join me in opening the Bible together. We're going to open the Bible to John chapter 6. And so I'm going to read for us all the way from verse 1 to verse 27. Up to this point, John, one of Jesus' best friends, one of the eyewitnesses to Jesus' life, death, and resurrection, one of the 12 apostles, is introducing us to Jesus. And he's introducing us to Jesus in a variety of different ways. First, by introducing us to people that don't get Jesus, people who are skeptical of Jesus, and even the disciples themselves who were right next to Jesus but didn't get him. And so that means we're invited, and I hope you feel this way, that we're invited to bring our skepticism, to bring our questions to Jesus. They don't hurt his feelings. They don't scare him. He's not surprised when people don't quite get him. And John wants to invite us into seeing that, that Jesus is a teacher. He's not only authoritative and he is God with us and for us, but he is a patient and he is a kind and he is a gentle mentor. And so we're going to read beginning in verse 1, picking up where we left off, all the way through verse 27 of chapter 6. Now, after this, Jesus went away to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, which is the Sea of Tiberias. And a large crowd was following him because they saw the signs that he was doing on the sick. Jesus went up on the mountain, and there he sat down with his disciples. Now, the Passover, the feast of the Jews, was at hand. Lifting up his eyes then and seeing that a large crowd was coming toward him, Jesus said to Philip, "Where are we to buy bread so that these people may eat?" He said this to test him, for he himself knew what he would do. Philip answered him, 200 denarii worth of bread would not be enough for each of them to get a little. One of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, "There's a boy here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish. But what are they for so many?" Jesus said, "Have the people sit down." Now there was much grass in the place. So the men sat down, about 5,000 in number. Jesus then took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, he distributed them to those who were seated. So also the fish, as much as they wanted. And when they had eaten their fill, he told the disciples, "Gather up the leftover fragments, that nothing may be lost." So they gathered them up and filled 12 baskets with fragments from the 5 barley loaves left by those who had eaten. When the people saw the sign that he had done, they said, "This is indeed the prophet who is to come into the world." Perceiving then that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king, Jesus withdrew again to the mountain by himself. When evening came, his disciples went down to the sea, got into a boat, and started across the sea to Capernaum. It was now dark, and Jesus had not yet come to them. The sea became rough because a strong wind was blowing. When they had rowed about 3 or 4 miles, they saw Jesus walking on the sea and coming near the boat, and they were frightened. But he said to them, "It is I. Do not be afraid." Then they were glad to take him into the boat, and immediately the boat was at the land to which they were going. On the next day, the crowd that remained on the other side of the sea saw that there had been only one boat there, and that Jesus had not entered the boat with his disciples, but that his disciples had gone away alone. Other boats from Tiberias came near the place where they had eaten the bread after the Lord had given thanks. So when the crowd saw that Jesus was not there, nor his disciples, they themselves got into the boats and went to Capernaum, seeking Jesus. When they found him on the other side of the sea, they said to him, "Rabbi, when did you come here?" Jesus answered them, "Truly, truly, I say to you, you are seeking me not because you saw signs, but because you ate your fill of the loaves. Do not work for the food that perishes, but for the food that endures to eternal life, which the Son of Man will give to you. For on him, God the Father has set his seal." May God inhabit the reading and the teaching of his words in such a way that this becomes more than just ink on a page, but becomes the very words of God to us. And the last chapter, the very last phrase, and you can even read there with me, verse 46 and 47, "For if you believe Moses," Jesus says, "you would believe in me, wrote of me, but if you not believe his writings, how will you believe my words?" And so Jesus makes an allusion to Moses, a hero of the Jewish faith, and leaves us asking the question, okay, so what does Moses have to do with us, do with this? And the answer, chapter 6. What's Jesus and Moses got to do with one another? The answer, John gives us, again in chapter 6. So here's what, on a regular basis, I'm going to give us kind of a moment maybe to reflect on this and as we dig into thinking about what that means for us. On a regular basis, we get together and we say things like, Jesus is Lord over everything, over every square inch of all of creation. And then when you say the good news of who he is and what he has done applies to everything, everywhere. What I fear is, and what I confess is, that in the moments of our actual lives, I don't think he really matters. In the moment of hunger we see here, all we can usually see is hunger. In the heat of the moment of anger or strong emotions, we often cannot see how Jesus has anything to do with our present reality. I'll confess to you, even in my wife and I are arguing over something, that moment, the height of those emotions, the things that seem so important, make it almost impossible, if not completely impossible, to see Jesus at all. And so while on a regular basis we say things like Jesus is Lord over everything, I fear that in the moment when we're actually walking through life, in the moment where our real emotions, our real response, the reality that's 6 inches in front of our faces, the things we can touch, see, and feel, make it almost impossible to think that that really matters. And John invites us to at least two different things here in the sixth chapter that allow us, I hope, to connect the dots. What's Jesus got to do with my suffering, with my present reality, my present hardship, my present difficulty? And John tells us two more of what he calls signs so that we would look through them and see Jesus. Now remember, John, more than any other gospel, talks about Jesus and the miracles that he works as signs. He sees them as pointers, right? And so the analogy we'll come back to even is the picture of like a stop sign, right? When you come up to a stop sign has no power to pull you over, write you a ticket. A stop sign has no ability to sentence you or fine you. The stop sign has no authority in and of itself, right? But it points to ones who do. The stop sign can't do anything to you, but it points you to someone who can. So also, when Jesus does some of these things, we're invited to realize that Jesus ultimately isn't pointing to himself as a miracle worker. He is working miracles to introduce himself as the divine answer and solution to every single thing that is broken in the world by sin. Now, I'm going to run through some of these things I think that the text exposes for us. And so I want to encourage you, you don't have to feel the need to like write all this down. We're going to attach all these things to our media page when we upload our sermon within 24 hours of the time that we're done. So our website and our media will have an attachment there. You'll have a file. So you don't feel the need to get all of this. I really want to do what John does here, and I want in rapid succession to, and in some sense, like pound you with what Jesus is really showing us about himself. He's pointing to himself. Not as just a miracle worker, which is what these people seem to want, but he's introducing himself as a divine answer. Now, we saw last week he's the divine answer and authoritative word over brokenness and healing, but even over rest and Sabbath. And so let's look through the signs, right? When you see that stop sign, you don't stop because you think that sign is going to do anything to you, right? You look through the sign. You recognize that through that sign is an authority over you. And you respond to the sign based on what you see through it. And so let's do that. We look through two of those signs here. Jesus does two of these miracles. He feeds a bunch of people, and then he walks on the water. And presumably, we even see implied here, like the other Gospels tell us, that the weather that was hindering these people and all of a sudden somehow becomes no obstacle. And while they were halfway across the lake, when Jesus gets in the boat, something miraculous happened again. And so these are signs, and if we look through them, I think we'll see this. Jesus allows hunger in deserts and uncertainty in storms so that we will see him as our satisfaction and safety. Jesus allows hunger in deserts so that we'll see him as our satisfaction, and then he allows uncertainty in storms so that we will see him as our ultimate peace and safety. And when we look through these signs, we see something about Jesus. First, we see the sufficiency of his power. But we also see, secondly, the invitation to be witnesses of and even channels of his power. Thirdly, I think we also see the abundant measure of his power. So Jesus isn't doing these things so that we will just think that he's amazing. He is doing these things so that we will ultimately have satisfaction and peace. The kind of satisfaction and peace that come in deserted places where there is no sustenance, and in stormy places where there seems to be no calm. So this miracle is it's the only miracle other than the death and resurrection of Jesus that is recorded by all the Gospels. Think about that just for a minute. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John disagreed on different things, right? You've got like John, you've got like Mark, who are like Scrooge, they're like humbug, we're not even celebrating Christmas, right? Because they think that's less important. Just think about that as you're preparing for Christmas, right? They're real excited about the incarnation, not necessarily excited about Christmas, right? The coming of God to be with us. Someone last week, they were asking, like, do you think Christians should celebrate Halloween? And I'm like, I don't think all Christians should celebrate Christmas because of this awful, consumeristic, superficial, ungodly ways that they celebrate Christmas. I'm like, I don't think, who cares? You don't really think there's a God anyway, right? Like, so there's a sense in which, like, when we find agreement like this, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, at the very least, know that the people who are going to read their Gospels will agree on one thing. Jesus sustains, he miraculously feeds the 5,000, and he died and came back to life. Get the picture? So this is an important set of miracles we see here, specifically the one we'll spend the most of our time on, that Jesus feeds a multitude of people. So let's just walk through it. Jesus goes to the Sea of Galilee, and then, just so you know, John gives us the name that was probably most likely known by the Romans, who started to understand the name of that lake related to the name of the city that was named after a Roman official. Verse 2, and a large crowd was following him because of the signs they saw that he was doing on the sick. Notice, the crowd wasn't following him because they wanted to obey him, but just like the ones described in chapter 2 that Jesus would not give himself over to, it says that they were following Jesus because of the miraculous signs. Verse 3, Jesus went up on the mountain, and there he sat down with his disciples. And this is interesting. He goes up the mountain, and the people follow him. He goes up to a remote place. He goes into a desolate place, maybe even a deserted place, and the people follow him. Now, I want you to see this throughout the entirety of the Bible. This miracle that we're about to see is on repeat. The way that God demonstrates his power over and over and over again is by bringing life where there was not. God brings power by bringing life where there was not. There was no life, there was nothing. God speaks, there is life. That's the story of the Bible. Now, we exercise power often, and we are marveling at power often that actually removes life. Right, the power that we are most in awe of, that we're most shocked by, is when there's a power demonstrated that removes life, that takes life away. And so this is sort of right, but like on a regular basis, even when a tragedy like a hurricane hits, how do we usually measure the effect? We usually say something like the death toll. And so we see a little bit of this, right? We kind of peek into this a little bit, that there is power most aptly displayed over when or aptly displayed when it's power over life and death. But notice that the power that God demonstrates on a regular basis is not just power to destroy and remove life, which is, I think, probably the best we can do, but the power to create life and bring life, the power to sustain life, the power to restore life. That's especially important because if you remember, John's answer in all of chapter 6 is to call back to a man by the name of Moses. A man by the name of Moses whose power as power of God was flowing through him was demonstrated in that he every single day as God's people as they were delivered were wandering through the wilderness, there was what was called manna. Manna, a mysterious, in fact, the word manna is a word of mystery. It's like, it's a questioning word that this mysterious sustenance allowed them to live even as they were wandering through the desert. Over and over and over again, God's power is made manifest in the way that God saves lives, and even brings life. And so don't miss that. This story of the Bible is visible in this miracle. Jesus demonstrates his power not by killing people, but by giving them life. Now that's awesome because you have to see and marvel at God sustaining these people, even in their momentary hunger, as they go to this remote, desolate, deserted mountain. That's how God just introduces himself, as someone who brings life where there's not. Think of it this way. Only an artist who truly loves the medium of life does something like create 400,000 species of beetles. That's all that we know of, more than 400,000. Like, why not 200,000, right? Nah. Right, only a God who really is an artist, who revels in and enjoys demonstrating his life-giving power, does things like, I don't know, invent skunks, right? And porcupines and giraffes and duck-billed platypuses. Like, what? Let's make one of these. Right? Like, that's... I don't know what you think of, like, a skunk. I'm going to make one that it smells awful. Only a God who creates and with such a love and value of life would do something like that. Right? 400,000 beetles, insects, make up like half of the species we even know to exist on the world. And most of them eat what? They thrive on poop. Just think about the artist that made that, right? I'm gonna make these animals, and they're gonna eat the other things poop, and then the things they poop, the plants are gonna eat, and then someone's like, well, then what's gonna happen? The plants are gonna poop out something like oxygen that everyone else is gonna live off of. Yes, you get it. Like don't miss this. Our God loves most to flex his muscles and demonstrate his power by bringing life where there's not. And so Jesus introduces himself. I'm that one. I'm with that God. Remember, we're going to draw lines back to chapter 5 for the rest of the entire book. I'm God. What kind of God are you? I'm a God who brings life. You're going to kill everybody? No. I'm going to bring life to the full. We use crayons, right? He uses creatures. Verse 4, one of the most important verses in the passage, right? We're looking through Jesus, going to see something. Verse 4, now the Passover, the feast of the Jews, was at hand. Now, if you'll remember, a couple months ago when we began to launch gospel communities, we saw Luke do the same thing, right? When Peter was in prison and he was set free and they were like, and it happened to be the Passover, right? The same thing's going on here. There are at least three different Passovers that John tells us about. This is the second one. The first Passover Jesus experienced, so if you remember, he was in the temple and he made a threat. Like, I'm going to tear this temple down. This is the greatest holiday and nationalistic pride would have been experienced right by these people. And he's like, I'm going to tear down your temple. And they're like, well, how will we mediate? How will we experience the presence of God? And Jesus is like, that's a good question. I'll tear this down and I'll raise it up on the third day. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge, right? And so the first Passover, he's like, I'm going to mediate for you. I'm going to be this for you. This is the second Passover. Same thing. Wink, wink, like nudge, nudge. It happened to be the Passover. It just happened. Coincidentally, It was also the Passover. And so he says this, I think John says this, not necessarily to give us a chronological update. He does that because he even tells us, hey, there was a lot of grass around, which gives us the right kind of season, spring, that's absolutely the case that it would have been. It would have been burned up by the end of the year. But his point isn't necessarily chronological. It's theological. What point is he making? Well, he's hearkening us back to the Exodus. The Exodus, where God delivered his people, and by the blood of the slain lamb and the death of so many firstborn, Pharaoh then set his people free, sent them off. And so we're meant to look through this sign and see Lamb, Lamb of God, slain Lamb for our deliverance, manna, bread, sustenance from heaven, and even, this will blow your mind, even the crossing of turbulent waters, the Red Sea. So the reason verse 4 is important, it's a window. It's a window into all the themes of this entire chapter. Now, they're complex connections. Sacrifice lamb, right? Anticipating Jesus' death. The Old Testament manna that ultimately points to what we'll see next week as the bread of life. And this kind of thing just kind of rolls off the tongue once you start connecting the dots. They're complicated, but don't miss the information, or excuse, don't miss transformation for the sake of information. I know some of you are nerding out right now. You're like, oh, he connected the dots between the Old and New Testament, and your mind's blown, right? But beware. Don't get so caught up on the information that you miss the point here, which is transformation, to see God as he truly is revealed to us in Jesus. This is a rallying point. Verse 5. We're introduced to another character. Lifting up his eyes, then we see a large crowd. He was coming toward him. Jesus said to Philip, now, this is interesting. Philip, we find out, if you remember, when Eric was preaching through the first couple chapters of the Gospel of John, he introduces us to Philip, and Philip was from this area. So it's really interesting. Jesus asks a hard question because he's a good teacher. Saw the people. Says, hey, Philip. And this is his hometown, right? Now, you do this on a regular basis, right? When you go someplace, you ask someone local, hey, where should we eat? Does the same thing, but he does it in such a way to test him, we find out in verse 6. Hey, Philip, this is where you're from. If we were going to feed all these people, where would you get the bread? And Philip says, man, if we had this much money, right? If we had all these, like this, these are almost a year worth of day's wages, right? Whatever you make, your salary, that's a good parallel. But this is really interesting. Jesus is testing him because he actually leads people out into the wilderness without food. Now, this is a hard one to say, much less to hear. Jesus knowingly walked out there, knowingly led these people into the mountain, up away to a desolate place where Philip tells us, even the local boy says, look, there's no place that we could afford to feed all these people. It doesn't exist. And we see something profound about Jesus. Not only does he ask hard questions, but he also leads people sometimes in hard places. I hope more than anything else. I mean, you must think Exodus, right? You have to think Exodus. You have to think the deliverance of God's people and then the wandering for a generation in a desolate place, where they are required day by day to rely on the sustenance of God from above. This is what God does, and this is what we see here Jesus doing as well. And I think that you'll find that for some of you in this room that would call Jesus Lord, this is actually true for you. I don't know why he does it, but we get a hint as to why he might. Because on a regular basis, and I don't like this about God, I don't often possess the maturity to immediately understand this when I'm in a wilderness, in a desolate place. But I want you to be encouraged by this. The Exodus tells us a story about how God sustains people. He leads them out into wandering, into wilderness, so that they will see how good and caring he is. And John mentions this as well, so that we'll begin to immediately see Jesus as a teacher, He wants us to discover something. He knows that we are lacking, and he's willing to draw us into a place where there is no food so that he can become the source, ultimately, of the thing that we want. Now, here's where I know most of you are. Even right now, that haunts you, because if you were honest, you would say something like this: God, I can't see you. I don't know where you are. And this place where I'm currently living, this day-to-day of mine, is so desolate, I'm starving. And when you can't see him, I want to encourage you. It's possible that he may just be leading you through a desert to reveal himself as truly good. Then what happens next? Verse 9 is almost a resolution. I love Andrew. Andrew jumps in and says, look, there's a boy here who has 5 barley loaves. That would have been like the bread of the poor. There's a boy here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish. Now, these are small. This is a packed lunch here. This is not a feast. This is just probably enough for his lunch. He just happened to be, I guess, you know, shout out to moms here. His mom was like, hey, don't go without food. What are you, an idiot? And maybe 5,000 other men evidently didn't have a mom to help them in that way. But this little boy had an awesome mom who was like, hey, don't go without, you're gonna get hungry, right? And it would be really cool if Andrew just stopped right there, right? If that was the end of his sentence, it would be an amazing declaration of faith, right? We're in this desolate place. Jesus, there's a boy here and he's got a sack lunch. He's got a Lunchable, right? He's got something his mom made. He's got some leftovers that his mom made him. And it'd be great if he just stopped right there and Jesus would have been like, ah, that's a great point. Let's multiply this. Remember that time we made water into wine? This is we're going to do that same thing. But he doesn't. He doesn't end there. And often we are the same way. Look, there's a boy who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish. And then what does he say? What are they for so many? What's that going to do? What's that going to accomplish? And I want you to see here, this is an amazing thing that Jesus does. Jesus gets them to see and admit their limit. Then he starts to work through them. How do we do this? We must start by seeing God and confessing our own powerlessness in order to see and experience his power. The first things you do is you admit and confess your own powerlessness, the limits of your own ability to solve what it is that's in front of you. Now, I know for many of you, if hanging out with us on a Sunday morning is a regular thing, you knew that was coming, right? You're like, oh, there he goes again. I thought this was going to be the week that Jonathan tells me that I'm good enough and I'm awesome and I'm going to kill it this week. I thought surely this is the week Jonathan is going to tell me how awesome I am and that I've got everything I need. Everything I could possibly need is in myself. I'm good enough. I'm smart enough. People like me, right? Nope, not this week. The first step, even if it's out of cynicism or skepticism or even sarcasm, I think he's scoffing personally. If I speak in this way, it's a scoff. It's like, Jesus, look, here's this, but I mean, seriously, what's that got to do with anything? How is that going to fix anything? And that, interestingly enough, is a place where Jesus begins. In fact, I would argue that without that beginning, without at least admitting with some honesty, what on earth could we possibly do? Something amazing happens. And this is an important contribution, I think, he helps us to see. This is an important contribution that I would hopefully want to apply corporately. So if you're not a believer in this room, I'm really glad you're here. If you wouldn't call yourself a Christian, I'm really glad you're here. If you have deep questions about Christianity, I'm glad you're here, because I don't know if you just caught that. Jesus was surrounded by people just like us, right? With real questions like, Jesus, seriously, what's this got to do with anything? But I want to apply this specifically. And so if you're on the outside looking in, I want you to see how this ought to look in the life of our church. In the end, we think that in the hands of Jesus Christ, the insufficient becomes sufficient. In the hands of Jesus, the insignificant becomes significant. That's really important, because I know so many of you in this room can relate to this. This little boy is a nobody, and he's got nothing. And I know that most of you, your deepest fear, if you were honest with yourself, is that you are terrified that's actually true of you. That in fact, that you're a nobody, and you probably feel the same way. You're terrified that you're insignificant. There's no meaning to your life. There's no purpose. But don't miss, that's an important part of this story. That's the groundwork. That's the fertile soil in which Jesus actually works. Jesus gets them to see their limits, to admit their limits, and then he starts to work through them. Here's the way I would say it this way. If you think you are competent, if you have it all together, you can't be a channel of his power. And this, I hope, is even something that you recognize on a regular basis in the life of our church, especially in gospel communities, where we gather together not only corporately on a Sunday, but we scatter to begin to experience this with one another in the most intimate possible ways, where we willingly say, look, I don't got it together. Think of it this way. In gospel community and in the life of this church, we champion the admission of weakness and the confession of sin. Remember, this is an upside-down kingdom. Look, all your elected politicians think they're really winning by trying to distract from their weakness, right? Hide it, cover it up. Hopefully it doesn't get exposed. We're not like that. We actually lead with confession. We actually confess the log protruding out of our own eye before we ever would have the tenacity to point out a splinter, a flaw in someone else's. We lead with this. The heroes in our church are not the people who have it all together. They're the people who shout the most loudly that they do not. We are the people who champion this. I hope you've already seen this, right? And maybe this freaked you out. You sat down the first time you hung out with the gospel community and some people were like, man, I'm really sinning in this way. I've really harmed people in this way. And you probably were sitting there like, whoa, don't, who would say that? Exactly. Who would willingly expose their flaws except for one that knew that their flaws had already been healed? Who would willingly confess their sin unless they already knew that Jesus had paid for it? There's a radical good news underneath this, but I don't want you to miss the powerful implications. The inability to admit your own insufficiency is to miss Jesus altogether. Completely. Completely. I'll ask that for you in the life of this church. I don't know. What is your attendance, even in this worship service, like? Did you get dressed up so that people would see you at your very best? Or did you clothe yourself with humility and confession so that Jesus might restore you and bring life? This week, you attend a gospel community. What's your contribution? Are you the person that always has to have the right answer? Is it possible? Is it possible that by always trying to have the right answer and imposing that right answer on the people around you is actually a very transparent admission to people who are genuinely following Jesus that you've missed Jesus altogether? This is an upside-down kingdom. The ones who are the greatest are the ones who serve. The ones who are the first are the ones who are willing to be last. The Apostle Paul tells New Testament church the same thing. I'm pleading with God, pleading with him to heal me in this desolate place. And what was God's response to him in Christ? No, man. My grace is what's on display in your life right now. And it is sufficient. So the inability to admit your own insufficiency, the inability to receive that and confess that and your need for that is actually to miss Jesus altogether. This may seem like I'm pounding on a point unnecessarily. Almost every single week, I meet another person who says something like this. I've been a part of a church my whole life. I was raised in the church. And I've never heard the gospel until I was hanging around in a gospel community or have gathered together. I thought I was a Christian, but I really was just a moralistic do-gooder. I thought I was a Christian, but I really was just trying to prove myself. Don't miss this. To do that is to miss out on Jesus altogether. It's only when you take your insufficiency, and Jesus takes it, right? Like, what a jerk, right? Hey, kid, right? Why would he do that? Unless he was pointing to something much greater and much bigger. A second thing, not only do you have to see and confess your own powerlessness, but the second thing you see this, you must put everything into his hand. Because a little boy put everything into Jesus' hand, he and everyone else ended up eating more than what even existed. Think about that. Because he allowed this to be into Jesus' hands, it was made sufficient, it was made abundant, it was made miraculously beyond what we could ask or imagine here in this very tangible, physical way. And in the end, people started eating food that previously didn't even exist. Think about it. He was like conjuring up barley plants that had never been planted or lived, right? He was conjuring up fish that had never swam, right? He was just multiplying it. And when the little boy began to take his very meager, insufficient thing, Jesus did something amazing. Now, I don't want you to miss the really beautiful thing we see. Despite the size of the crowd, you can see this from verse 10 on, right? Jesus, like, make them sit down. And then we find out there's 5,000 in number, right? But that's just the men. Now, every one of the Gospels records this. Now, this could mean that there were at least maybe 15,000 people, because they only counted the men. You'll ask, why did they do that? Well, maybe you think it's like patriarchy, but I actually believe that it has more to do with, you know, because in a census, they would have counted households by the man. That's maybe a little bit, but I actually think it's because they wanted to give a conservative estimate. Every single one of these were like, look, there was a bunch, but we know for a fact there was 5,000 men. Like, when we did a head count, there was probably more. And I think that external evidence here, like, think about this. By the time the Gospels would have been circulated, if this kind of miracle wasn't true, Christianity would have never gotten off the ground, right? If at least 5,000 people, put this in perspective, right? 5,000 men with their families, let's say that's, you know, 15,000 people, okay? That's a sellout crowd at the Denny Sanford Premier Center, which seats like 12,000, 13,000 people depending on the event, okay? So if a sellout crowd at the Denny Sanford Center, like, and again, this is a crowd of people that probably didn't, you know, these were not like church-going people who cleaned up their act to get there, right? This was a festival, right? This was a rock concert out on a mountain, right? These were crowded people that wandered out into the mountain to see Jesus without thinking about food or like, hey, so someone had brought, was like set up some porta potties for this event, right? Like that's this kind of crowd. And then they're like, well, what do we do next? And Jesus allows them to be out in the wilderness and he feeds them. And if something like that happened at the Denny Sanford Premier Center, within 100 years after that would happen, there would probably still be some evidence hanging around. People saying, no, I was there, I saw it. And that's what we see here. But what do we learn about that large number? And then not only the large number, but you see right after that, they gathered up the leftovers so that nothing would be lost. Notice this, the bread that Jesus gives is super abundant. Super abundant. I know so many of you right now, I'm talking about Jesus, in the back of your mind, you're just thinking, you know what I'm supposed to do? I guess to be a Christian, I've just got to become miserable. I've got to give up these things, but I got to do all these things and not do all these things, so one day I'll get into heaven. And your picture of God is so small because you think he's somehow like just meagerly supplying for you. But notice what we see here. The super abundant nature of God's provision in Christ. Remember Exodus. The manna that they were being sustained by every day spoiled if they tried to take some more for the next day. What is Jesus? Gives us abundantly more. And then there's something pretty amazing here. There's 12 baskets full. Now I think most scholars believe that these 12 baskets are meant to have like an ominous kind of portending message to the 12 tribes of Israel, so that they would realize even in Jesus' work, there's enough left over for God's people. I think what we say here is that don't be envious of what God's doing over there. He has enough for you. He has enough. So here's what I think, as we kind of transition to that last little small piece of Jesus walking on water, I want you to see this, right? Jesus is the true and better Moses. The abundant source of bread and the better passage across chaotic water. Follow it with me. Verse 15. Now they try, now this is just a side here, they try to take by force, like make him king, because he put food in their bellies. Don't miss that. People trying to use Jesus to prop up their own political agendas is not new. Jesus is like, I'm out. I'm not in on your political move. I got a kingdom that's not of this world. It's upside down. It's gonna blow up. It's gonna turn everything upside down. So in verse 16, the evening comes and Jesus evidently walks across the water. It says they're about 3 miles into the storm. The lake itself is closer to about 6 miles across. And so they were probably halfway there and it took all night and they couldn't make any good headway. And in the middle of that, Jesus does something. He shows himself in the same way that he showed himself as super abundant. He shows himself as the giver of awe and yet peace. Now remember the first sign, Jesus turned water into wine. And it was the best wine. People were like, nobody's ever had wine this amazing. And Jesus was serving notice. For those of you who think that God's somehow withholding from you, that God's like ready to squash you and punish you, Jesus says, no, I am the Lord of the feast. To follow me is to experience abundance and to experience plenty. The blessings that you will have poured out on you through me are a feast that we will celebrate forever and ever and ever. And we saw this even at the end of the story. John tells us that blessed is the one, right, invited to the wedding feast of the Lamb. That's a blessing. But he does it again. Did you catch that? He didn't just give him enough to get to the next day. He gave him enough with leftovers so that we would see that Jesus is Lord of the feast and we see he's Lord of the storm. Don't miss that. I think we tend to like one to the detriment of the other. So much of what we see in the first sign actually just gets restated in the second sign. Remember, picture the Passover, right? As soon as God delivers them, the lamb, blood on the doorpost, and then what happens? The next thing that happens, they get to the Red Sea, and they're like, what do I do next? And what does God do? Miraculously delivers them across water. You got to get it. In the end, Jesus is the true and better Moses. Not only does he abundantly feed and provide for us and sustain us, but he also grants us peace in the midst of chaos. He's the one. He's the only one who can offer us safe passage. So some of you right now, I think, are probably living in a place that either you would describe as desolate and starving, or you might describe it as a storm. But don't miss this. Storms ultimately show the inadequacy of our own ability to get where we ought to be. Did you get that? He gets in the boat, and they're terrified by him, and he drops another bomb. Remember like the I am statements that John tells us? It says it is I, but that's actually really hard to translate into the English because we wouldn't use the word I am. He literally just says, I am. Just like there was another one that Moses told us of, the God that is. And they were given peace. They were given comfort. They invited him into the boat. And then immediately something miraculous happened. The storm evidently was calmed or something happened. They got to where they were going. Don't miss that. In the end, sometimes, and this might be the case for you, the storm you're living in might just be God's mercy to show you that you are currently putting all your weight in a boat that can't get through the storm. The storm you're probably living in right now might actually be God's mercy. I don't know. I don't know what that looks like for you. But it might actually be God's mercy to allow this chaos so that you'll stop hoping in your plan. I mean, don't you remember this in Matthew's gospel, right? Jesus tells a parable of a person who builds a house on what? Sand. And then another person who builds a house on what? Stone. And what exposed the false foundation? What was it that exposed the reality of the thing? It was a storm. The rains come, the waters rise, and only that which is firmly rooted, a firm foundation, a stone, and we see a rock of offense, but even a cornerstone for us, that is Christ, will stand the storm. And God in his mercy sometimes allows structures with false foundations to be blown away. So that at the bedrock, as we say, sometimes God allows us to hit rock bottom so that we'll realize there is a rock at the bottom. Storms just show the inadequacy of our own ability to get where we ought to be. Job loses everything. But what does he find in the end? That in God as creator, he has everything he needs. Jesus says, I'm the reason you shouldn't have fear. The storm will refine you. Sometimes the storm will temper what you really have. So maybe you're full of joy, but the storm will often allow your joy to also be complemented by the ability to have a deep empathy for people who are grieving. Maybe you have a lot of strong convictions like me, but the storm sometimes allows your convictions to actually shape you into a person that's actually approachable, tolerable to be around. Maybe you're fearless and courageous. Sometimes storms allow the other side of that coin to be shaped in humility. Maybe you're just full of love, but storms actually refine that love to where it's pure. Jesus allows some of those sufferings so that we'll be more and more like him. Don't miss it. Jesus sometimes allows hunger in the deserts and uncertainty in the storms so that we will see him as our satisfaction and safety. Would you now entrust yourself to him for nourishment and for calm? Would you begin to consider your own helplessness to actually sustain yourself and your own inability to get yourself where you really want to go, and then take in this Holy One? I know, just like the disciples, you'll be afraid at first, right? Even now you're approaching Jesus, and just like the disciples, you're like, ah, you're scary. But don't miss what he explains. Look, there's a bread that lasts. In the last verse we read, we find out that ultimately there is a sign in Jesus and his work that God has placed his seal upon him. So before I close, I want to give just a real practical application here. Don't miss the simplicity of these pictures. Right? They're deep and theological treatises in nature that we, as we plumb the depths of, will be overwhelmed, right? Like, oh my goodness, it's crazy. But don't miss this, especially for those of you who disciple children. The two core values of Kids Connection Next Door are this. The first thing we want to do is we want to teach kids the gospel. Our greatest hope for children isn't that they do wrong and right. Our greatest hope is that our children, is that when they do wrong, they'll experience God's mercy and grace and place their faith in it, okay? We don't want moral children. We want redeemed children. There's a big difference, okay? The second value is that we want to raise up people to help disciple those children. And so there's no babysitting going on next door, right? Who knows what's going on next door, actually? I mean, they're like, we would be bad babysitters because the thing we're the most excited about is whether or not that child heard the gospel. That while they were dead in sin, Jesus was sent to die for the ungodly. Don't miss, if you're a part of this, this means that there are pictures here that will help us display the gospel. Don't you love how John did this? Right? Like, if a child's like, hey, what's Jesus like? And it's like, well, it's like we're at a party, like a wedding, but the missing piece isn't there, and Jesus brings it, right? Oh, wow. What's Jesus like? It's like when you're thirsty. We saw this a few chapters ago. It's like when you're thirsty, and then you get that drink, and you feel better. That's what Jesus does to our souls, right? Or it's like whenever you're hungry, and then you eat something that's delicious. That's what Jesus does for our heart. Or it's like when you're in the midst of chaos, and you're afraid, and Jesus gets in the boat with you and casts out all your fear. Don't miss this. Maybe even as I say that, this maybe is a call for some of you to get off the bench and begin to declare the gospel to your children or to sign up for Kids Connection. I guarantee you, you guys are easier to explain the gospel to than them. If I read Jesus' words right, the goal isn't that those children would get into this room and become more like us. Jesus says to see the kingdom, all the people in this room have to look more like them. And so these metaphors are not only nourishing to our own soul and calm and give us peace and our own turbulence, but they're the means by which we can pass on the gospel in little acceptable tidbits. And maybe that's what some of you need to do. Because God has set his seal on this sign. Did you catch that? I say to you, you're seeking me. You wanted to see signs, or excuse me, not because you wanted to see signs. They didn't want to see the stop sign and look through it. They wanted to steal the stop sign and use it for their own purposes. And they were just using Jesus to get what they want. And Jesus says, look, God has placed a seal on what I'm doing. I'm the true and better Moses who can give you sustenance in the desert and calm in the storm. Let me end with this. Remember that stop sign analogy? Like the stop sign only has authority in that it points to a greater authority. It won't hurt you. I'm going to give you a practical analogy that you'll see, and I want you to be reminded of the sign and seal that Jesus is for us. Like good consumers, you may this week drive into a parking lot of a store. And those posers have done something at the front. Have you seen it? They have stuck a stop sign up by the door. Now, here's what I can tell you. They actually have no legal authority to prosecute you for that. It's a false sign. It can't actually do anything to you. Now, don't get me wrong. A police officer can give you a ticket for reckless driving anywhere, okay? So if you running through that stop sign and almost hitting someone looks like reckless driving, a police officer can give you a citation for that anywhere at any time. However, a police officer cannot give you a citation for failing to come to a stop in front of, say, Kohl's or Target or Shields. You know why? Because they have no authority to enforce it. That sign in the front, it's a fake. And every time you drive through, I hope you see it. I hope you stop because you love pedestrians, right? But I hope you see through that sign and realize it has no authority. And then being overwhelmed with joy that the sign that has been sealed by the Father is the true source of sustenance. It is the true source of calm in the storm. It, the sign and seal that we see on Jesus, says that He can actually calm your weary soul. He can actually satisfy what you're hungry for. And oh, friend, the deserted place you're living in, the chaotic storm you're walking through, is actually just a fertile ground for joy that erupts as we see God's sign and seal in Jesus. Would you entrust yourself to Him? Would you look to Him? Give Him your loaves. Give Him your little lunchable. And sit back and expect a feast. Let's pray. God, we thank You so much. I thank You for, even for me, for putting the gospel, the work of Your Son in Christ, into terms and in pictures that I can understand. When I'm baffled by who You are and what You've done, I thank You that You have made it possible for, like a child, to trust in the sustaining work of Jesus, and like a child to trust in the peace that comes from Jesus. If there's some in this room that just seems like an impossible task, they're living in a state of starvation, they're living in a deserted place, would You even now come to them, comfort them, give them food with abundance, show them that You are the Lord of the feast. You will not cast them out, but You will give them everything they need with baskets left over. If there's some in this room and we're living in chaos and we just don't know where this is all going to end, would You come and get into our boat, be close to us, let us entrust ourselves to You so that we would experience the peace that comes from knowing You and knowing Your power and authority over all that sets itself against us. We love You for this in Jesus' name. Amen.